The first problem is where you don't know what the initial substrate is, but I've told you that it's neither an alkyl halide nor a sulfonate. And that that substrate reacts with this compound and ethanol to form an ether. So part of the reason that I had indicated that this is neither an alkyl halide or a sulfonate is I was trying to steer you away from it being an SN1 or SN2 reaction. First, why would this be extraordinarily unlikely to be an SN2 reaction, even if I said that you could have an alkyl halide as the starting material? The reagents? What's wrong with the reagents for SN2? Well, for SN2, what kind of nucleophiles do we normally need? Strong nucleophiles, right? And so almost always that means something that's negatively charged. Well, we have a neutral molecule, ethanol, here. So that would be a nucleophile much more likely to be used in an SN1 reaction. Aside from that, we have an acid that's present. And in SN2 reactions, we generally have a base that is the nucleophile. So even if that acid didn't interfere in the sense it didn't cause a different side product, it would substantially slow down the reaction, which already is unfavorable in terms of SN2 because we do have that weak nucleophile. Could this in theory have been SN1? Possibly. Again, the acid may not have any kind of side effect, and since we do have the weak nucleophile, it would be able to participate in an SN1 reaction. But if I now tell you it's not the starting material that is, an alkyl halide or a sulfonate, have we in lecture gone over any other types of leaving groups that we'd be able to use in order to even have an SN1 reaction? Well, in lecture, no, we haven't. But is SN1 and SN2 the only way that we could make this product? No, what other way could we have? But it can't be E1 or E2 because those would make alkenes. Addition, electrophilic addition, which if we try to analyze this, notice that we have that top compound, paratoluene sulfonic acid. That is that easily manipulable, inexpensive, organic soluble solid that is a strong acid and has a non-reactive conjugate base. So if you've been making your flashcards, which how many of you have made your flashcards? Ooh, dear. Now, a few times this quarter, I've tried to tell you what has happened with past classes. And one of the big difficulties that comes is this test number 3, because all of a sudden you are responsible for mechanisms. Whereas in past exam, we had just SN1 and SN2, comparatively very small, easy mechanisms. So I'm hoping over the weekend you're going to start practicing with these flashcards, because one of the points of these flashcards would be exactly to recognize that because we have tosic acid there, that's a big clue that, based on what we've learned so far, this probably is some kind of electrophilic addition reaction. Well, if this is electrophilic addition, what kind of starting material do we need? An alkene. Well, look at the structure of the product. There really is only one alkene that would be possible. This one. Because if we tried to connect from the secondary carbon where the alcohol ends up, we tried to connect it with the carbon on the other side there, that carbon already has 4 bonds to it. We'd have to make a 5th bond, which is not possible. So the only way that you can make an alkene is over to the right. what the mechanism of this reaction looked like. And remember again, these mechanisms are not required as part of the problem. I'm just going over it as a way of review. So first step would be the double bond attacks H+. That's the point of the tosic acid. You form the carbocation, which then could be attacked by ethanol. That attack could technically occur from two different sides, but notice that the product does not show stereochemistry. So if the product does, well, of course, again, we're not supposed to be answering mechanism, but if I were to give you a problem where I don't show appropriate stereochemistry, we can simplify then and just show with a plain line that that alcohol has become attached, which there'll be a deprotonation step that occurs. But once it does, we've made the appropriate product. But this is only one form of electrophilic addition. We could also use oxymercuration demercuration. Technically, alkoxymercuration demercuration, which would look like this. And this wouldn't be related to this problem, because the problem does give you a specific set of reagents. But I just want to show it's possible. Oh, sorry. There you go. That it is possible to make this product from the same starting material using a different set of reagents. So first, if we have mercury acetate with ethanol, not water, and then we react it with sodium borohydride, the following would occur. Double bond attacks mercury, causing one of the acetates to be kicked off. At the same time, mercury comes back and forms a ring. We have that cyclomercurinium ion, which, since we now have ethanol, not water, in the solution, that's what's going to attack and push open the ring. Once that occurs, we'll have deprotonation. We make our intermediate, which technically would be isolatable. But we then take it and react it with sodium borohydride, which kicks off mercury and leaves us the target ether. Why would you use this mechanism or this set of reagents instead of the first set of reagents that I showed you? If we were worried about carbocation migration. Questions about this first problem? All right, then the second problem. So we have a dihalide molecule with a bromine and a fluorine on it. And I had said that let's imagine that that reacts with just one equivalent of sodium hydroxide. What kind of reaction is going to occur here? SN2. Why? Because we have primary substrate and we have a strong, basic, non-hindered nucleophile. So SN2 reaction that's going to get us really only one product. Because fluorine is a very poor leaving group because it's the conjugate base of a weak acid. So it really doesn't want to get kicked off. Bromine is the conjugate base of a very strong acid. It's a very good leaving group. So given one equivalent only of sodium hydroxide, it really is only going to kick off the bromine. All right, the third problem. We have a mesylate, a methane sulfonate, that reacts with some kind of material. To form a functional group that we've never discussed before. Now, if you read the SN1, SN2 chapter very closely, you might have remembered seeing this particular ion. Does anybody happen to recall what the ion is called, this N3 ion? It's known as the azide. So this is an alkyl azide. What kind of reaction appears to have occurred here? Again, SN2. Again, it's a primary substrate, which means we're going to want something that's negatively charged as our nucleophile. And also notice that this is substitution. We go from having a mesylate to an azide, and it occurs with inversion of configuration. So primary substrate, with inversion and its substitution. So that means it's SN2, which means we need a good nucleophile. So the nucleophile in this case is the azide ion itself, which let me write out a Lewis dot structure for that. And in fact, let me write out two Lewis dot structures for that. So the structure on the right is useful for illustrating why is it that this compound, or these types of compounds, can be explosive. Because if you were to break the left nitrogen-nitrogen single bond, you would be able to spit off diatomic nitrogen, which is generally thermodynamically very, very favorable to produce nitrogen in this way. So that structure explains some of the reactivity of azide compounds. But the first structure is a bit more correct because that has charge evenly balanced across the molecule. By having the symmetry like that, it more closely matches what you would observe in real life. So I'll use that first version of the Lewis dot structure to show the mechanism of what would occur here. So either side of the azide ion simply attacks the mesylate and kicks it off. Simple SN2 substitution that causes the inversion and gets us in one step to our product. So it's just the azide ion, or if you were going to correctly write the answer, I'd show a counter ion as well. Sodium is most commonly the one found, so sodium azide. Now, let's skip the fourth one just for a moment, because that's, to me, the most interesting one, but the one least likely to reflect what you're going to find on the exam. This quarter, it's much more like a new type of problem that we're going to start getting next quarter, but I wanted to introduce this quarter. So let's go to the one that involves the alkene connected to a cyclohexane ring. So we had some unknown substrate reacting with this compound to form an alkene. What kind of reaction is occurring here? It's definitely elimination, because that's the only reaction we've learned so far that makes alkenes. Is this E1 or E2? It's E2. Why? Not because of the substrate. You know, the substrate could determine whether E1 would be possible or not. But it's E2 because of the nucleophile used. This is a strong, basic, hindered nucleophile. I've written it as KO without a bond being shown between them and without charges being shown. But recognize that potassium is an ion. And so if I write KO, that's really the same thing as saying K plus attached to a negatively charged oxygen. Having shown you that, though, let me restate a similar warning that I made a few days back, which is if I have a hydrogen attached, that it is not the same thing as saying that the hydrogen dissociates to form an oxygen minus, because that hydrogen is not very acidic. It's got a pKa of maybe 18 in solution, which means it's less acidic than water. Does not want to dissociate on its own. Very unfavorable to do so. So if I had used a neutral molecule like, or a non-charged molecule like that T-butanol, one-dimethyl ethanol, that would have to have undergone E1 reaction. But we didn't have that. We did have the ionic conversion. So strong, basic, hindered nucleophile means E2. If we have E2, what does that mean that our starting material had to have in it? If we had E2, what did we have to have? Some kind of leaving group, correct? Because that's the only way elimination can happen. It can't just be a hydrogen. Hydrogens do not normally eliminate. A hydrogen, of course, is pulled off during an elimination reaction, but because next door there's a leaving group. If all you had was hydrogens, period, nothing would happen. Can't be hydroxide either, because that's not a leaving group. So we need a halide or a sulfonate. Some were in my answer. For simplicity, I'll just choose bromide. Part of the reason I keep choosing bromide for so many of my examples is because bromine is a good leaving group, but it's also it is relatively easy to synthesize alkyl bromides. Iodide is a better leaving group, but it can be trickier to make iodides because they often, at least in light, decompose. So you can use chloride, bromide, iodide, or mesylate or tosylate. So I'm just going to arbitrarily choose bromide. But let's think now, where would the bromine need to be located? Because if we're going to form a double bond between these two positions, and if this kind of anionic reaction occurs without any kind of rearrangements, that means that the leaving group needs to start out at one of the two carbons of this compound. So let's figure out whether or not it matters which one of those positions we put it at. Could E1 elimination occur to give us the correct product if we had the bromine on the primary position? Yes, and in fact, it's the only possible product of elimination because there's only one neighbor that has hydrogens on this compound. So in other words, in elimination, you would be extraordinarily unlikely to have any kind of side products in this case. So the mechanism would look like this. The T-butoxide ion would pull off the hydrogen. The pair of electrons that had been in that carbon-hydrogen bond could fall back to attack the leaving group, bromine, kicking it off, making the correct alkene. So that's a valid starting material. What about the other position? If we had the bromine at the tertiary position instead, would that undergo E2? It'd be the only thing possible. You might try to make some argument that in the first case, you could say, well, couldn't SN1 happen because that's a primary substituent? My response to that would be no, because you've got enough steric hindrance around that position that it would be probably unlikely to substitute easily. That's the whole point of using one of these bulky bases. Down here, because this is tertiary, it can't do SN2, period. It won't do SN1 because this is a strong bulky nucleophile, so it wouldn't even give SN1 a chance to occur. So E2 is going to be the only thing that happens in this case. But which E2? Because we do have two different neighbors now. We have the one that would give us the product that we want. So if we had T-butoxide pull off a primary hydrogen, which again would cause this cascade, we'd get the product we want. But from that same starting material, there's another possibility, in theory at least. What if instead a hydrogen is pulled off from the ring? Same type of thing could occur. Since there's two hydrogens on that position, we'd be guaranteed that one of them would be able to achieve the anti-periplanar configuration that is required to have elimination occur. But this gives us a different product, not the one we want. Which one of these two products is thermodynamically more favorable? Turns out it is the one on the right, which we haven't formally discussed this yet. And in fact, we'll have one more discussion after the exam of a way that we could experimentally demonstrate that one of these is more stable than the other. As far as the explanation versus the experiment, look at how many substituents are connected to the double bond. In this first case, we have two alkyl substituents connected. In the second case, we have three alkyl substituents connected. You might say, well, why does it matter how many substituents we have? Well, for just a moment, let's look at another example of the same type of thing, and then we'll come back and answer this question of what's really going to happen. So the short side story is the following. Let's say we have some arbitrary base. And let's say for the sake of argument that we're not worried about substitution, that for whatever magic reason, only elimination is going to occur. So if elimination occurs, we theoretically have three products that can form. One where elimination occurs to the primary position. And then a second case is where it eliminates to the secondary position. But if it eliminates to the secondary position, then we have both cis and trans that can form. Now let's look at the case of what is called this terminal alkene. Terminal because one of the carbons that's involved in the double bond is at the end of the molecule. The other pair of molecules, those would both be called internal alkenes. Well, if we look at the terminal alkene, and if we did a highly simplified smog diagram, where I show only the p orbitals that are part of the pi bond, and the sp3 hybrids on just the carbon immediately neighboring on the alkyl group. There are, of course, hydrogens not being shown here. Very, very incomplete diagram. Point of the diagram is just to draw enough to show that we're going to have the same type of hyperconjugation interaction possible as we would if this was a carbocation. Similar to the type of situation we discussed previously, the hydrogens that are otherwise attached to the double bond, they are 90 degrees to the pi bond. So there is no hyperconjugation in those directions where there's just a hydrogen there. There's hyperconjugation only to where the alkyl substituent is. So we have one R group, which means one hyperconjugation interaction. Let's take the cis alkene, the internal double bond, and see how it differs. Not S with a sigma. Right. So if you look back at all I haven't drawn the hydrogens in here, but there would be a hydrogen there. But it's not the S orbital of the hydrogen that's doing it, it's the sigma bond that forms there. So looking at the internal case, we have two alkyl groups. Again, highly simplified, just going to draw the sp3 orbitals that would be on that carbon of the neighboring groups. Now, because we have two alkyl groups, we have two places where that overlap occurs. If I were to draw the other two hydrogens attached to the double bond in, those hydrogens again are going to be 90 degrees to the double bond itself, which means they're not going to have any hyperconjugation. So two R groups means two hyperconjugation interactions. Those hyperconjugation interactions act to stabilize the pi bond. And so same type of reasoning as we had before with carbocations. In that case, we said the carbocations were more stabilized by having this hyperconjugation. And for alkenes end up more stable the more alkyl groups that you have attached to them. So when comparing a series of isomeric alkenes, you know, technically we can only compare things that are isomers if we originally want to say this word stable. But we are comparing isomers here. They're all degrees of unsaturation. 1 degree of unsaturation with 4 carbons means take 2 away from the number of carbons you'd normally count. 4 carbons, 2 times 4 plus 2 gives us 10. Subtract 2 would give us 8 hydrogens. So these 3 compounds are all C4H8, and we can therefore directly compare energies. When comparing a series of isomeric alkenes, The more substituted alkene will generally be the thermodynamically most favored alkene. Now, that would make us think that one of the internal alkenes should form in preference to the terminal one. But we have two different cases for the internal, cis and trans. So there, which one of those two compounds would be most favorable? The trans alkene. Why? Because it avoids steric hindrance. The cis alkene, those two substituents, although they're kind of pointed away from each other, they're still close enough, because don't think it as the little sticks that we draw it. Think that there's three hydrogens attached to those methyl groups as well. So that branching brings those groups close enough that you have steric hindrance in the cis case that is avoided in the trans. So also, I'll add on to this sentence. Trans alkenes are more stable than the related cis alkenes due to lower steric hindrance between substituents. So, I'll give you a moment to finish writing that, and then let me pull this back down so we can jump back into our discussion of that cyclic compound. Yes? Okay, so let me go ahead and pull that down.
So that tertiary butoxide, or that tertiary butoxide attacks that on the right, on the very right. So that reaction does not occur because that hydrogen is less exposed to the nucleophile.
Ah, so. Actually correct, but that's not what I implied the first time through.
But that can also be another reason.
But that is exactly the reason why this is still the only thing that occurs. So what I had said initially is, here's this hydrogen that could be removed that should get us this product. I then said, well, here's this other hydrogen that could be removed to get us another product. I then took us on this detour just for a moment to talk about what should be the more thermodynamically stable alkene. Between the two possibilities, which of these two is the thermodynamically more stable alkene? The one on the left or the one on the right? The one on the right, because it's got three alkyl substituents on it instead of two. But what you just said is exactly right, that when you get a hindered enough base, that base then has difficulty accessing the hydrogen. It becomes a kinetic effect. And so although thermodynamically one of the products may be more favorable, if physically the reaction is difficult to occur, that will slow it down. By using a bulky enough base, it slows down that reaction enough that removal of a primary hydrogen becomes enough easier that it can lead to the formation of an unfavorable product. That's exactly what occurs with this kind of base. What that means, as far as the answer to this problem, is that either of these two positions for the leaving group, in this case alone, would have been acceptable. Because in both cases, elimination would only occur one way. So let me pull this out of the way. So if you didn't finish writing, you could. And then now let me go ahead and... Sorry, say that one more time. So you're talking about this one versus this one? Only this one's going to occur as the major product. Because it's a primary hydrogen versus a secondary. And that's a kinetic effect where the base has difficulty getting to the hydrogen's position. It causes what's known as anti-Zaitsev elimination. Do you all remember us describing that term Zaitsev elimination before? When we went over E2 mechanisms? Zaitsev elimination is the tendency for the thermodynamically more stable alkene to form. But if you throw a kinetic factor in there, well, then that can cause the exact opposite behavior. So let me write a bit of this down. In fact, since I just here finished that description of the thermodynamically more favored alkene, let me restate Zaitsev elimination. So Zaitsev elimination means during elimination, the thermodynamically more stable alkene tends to form. Why? Because the most energy would be released forming that most stable alkene. But then here's where T-butoxide's role comes in. If the base used in elimination is very bulky, more specifically, has a great amount of steric hindrance, it is possible to form, or is possible to cause, anti-Zaitsev elimination, which means formation of the less substituted, less favorable thermodynamic product. Again, the reason this occurs is because physically that bulk prevents the easy removal of the hydrogen. And although this form of reaction coordinate diagram is not something that will be on an exam this quarter, it's a very prominent feature of one of the problems next quarter. But I wanted to again put up this reaction coordinate diagram that I might have shown the other day. To graphically show this situation. Imagine that we had our substrate and that we had the possibility of forming our internal versus terminal alkenes. Well, the internal alkene is more thermodynamically safe, stable, because it has more substitution, so it's going to be lower in energy. But what if the proton to get to that product is more difficult to remove? Well, then by using a bulky base, you may end up causing it to have a high activation energy, even though it would then form the more favorable product. That could be in comparison to making a terminal alkene, which may end up having an easier transition state to reach, easier meaning lower energy. Well, in this situation, if you had low temperature and the reaction was looking at getting over one of these two activation barriers, well, the smaller activation barrier is going to be far more easily crossed. And if you're at low energy, which means you have a distribution of molecular energy so that you don't have very many fast-moving molecules, well, the lower the reaction barrier, the faster the reaction is going to go. So particularly at low temperatures in these kinds of situations, whatever happens first is the product that you're going to get. And in this case, because of the lower activation barrier, the terminal or less substituted alkene would be formed. Conversely, if you were to raise the temperature where you had more molecules that maybe could get over that higher activation barrier, or where we're going to bring this discussion next quarter is to talk about a reversible reaction. If you had particularly a reversible reaction that could go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth across these hills, making the most stable product would make the product that would least likely want to react in reverse, because that reverse reaction activation energy would be the tallest of any of the reactions possible here. This is called thermodynamic versus kinetic control. So most eliminations occur thermodynamically, but by having that bulky base, it could cause the kinetic product, the less favorable product, to form. So now wrapping this up and going back to what was originally asked, that something reacts with potassium tetoxide in order to form this specific alkene. Because it is a strong hindered base, the two answers allowable are this. Or this. Questions on this problem? All right, we got two more. Yes. You would only need to put one. Yeah. Generally, on these types of fill-in-the-blank questions, if you have a substrate missing, you only need to provide one answer. If the products are missing, you're almost always directed to show all major possible products. Like this next problem, where if we start out with cyclohexene, and react it with bromine. No light, no water, just plain bromine. What are we going to get? Well, let's write the mechanism out for practice. Alkene attacks bromine. Bromine attacks back. Bromide is kicked off at the same time. We make a cyclic intermediate that is achiral. Because even though I'm using wedges, recognize that that is currently, effectively, a mesostructure, because you can write a mirror plane all the way through it. But from the structure, because it's symmetric, either position could be attacked. And depending on which of the two positions get attacked, you're going to end up with two distinct products. So it's not that the two can occur simultaneously on the same molecule. I'm just saying two different approaches are possible. And what you'll end up with is a set of enantiomers. Because when that second bromine comes into attack, we end up with a trans substitution pattern, which is not meso. And because attack is possible at either position, that's where we end up with the enantiomers. So the two of those products would be the answer for this problem. The last one I saved for last because it's our first example problem of a multi-step synthesis where you produce some material that then reacts in some secondary reaction to make the eventual product, which is in fact what you're going to be doing in lab. Because I did not actually teach the lab for this course the last time I did teach the course, I had forgotten from the previous year even that the alkyne reaction that we're supposed to be beginning now, we don't provide the starting material because you made it. When you took the stilbene, reacted it with bromine to make the stilbene dibromide, that is the reagent that you're going to be using for this alkyne reaction. We did have some of that starting material available, but it has been used up, and unfortunately, it's $200 just for 25 grams, a very expensive material. So, if you have not already begun the alkyne reaction, you're going to use your own solid that you were saving for the NMR from the previous experiment. Now, some of you might not have formed the 800 milligrams that it asks for in the procedure, and that's fine. You just need to adjust your quantities accordingly. So if you only made 400 milligrams, for example, of your product, then you would cut everything in half. Now, what if some of you didn't end up with product? Well, almost everybody did. And since most of you have a fair amount of that product, I'll just ask that if you end up with none, that you would find someone that would be willing to share with you. But back on track before we get too sidetracked with lab, let me show you this last problem. Which I didn't write it quite this way the first time, but this is essentially what is implied by the two boxes. That there's some reagent that makes some kind of stopping off point. Some intermediate structure that then undergoes a second reaction to make this product. You might be tempted to look at this and say, ooh, maybe there's some kind of SN1 possible here. Because you know that SN1 occurs with the possibility of carbocation rearrangement. But this starting molecule can't do SN1 because that's a primary position. So what other approach might we be able to take? Well, what if we could somehow get both of these carbons where the functional group starts out with and where the product ends up at, what if we can get them both involved at the same time? Well, we do know a way of doing that. An alkene. You know, what if we had an alkene at this position between the tertiary carbon and the methyl group? If so, couldn't we just take that alkene, react it with HCl, and we get the correct product? Well, yes, because that would be simple electrophilic addition, the very first type of mechanism I showed you Tuesday. It would also be the correct type of regiochemistry. That would be the Markovnikov product, by far the more likely product to form. Are we able to form this alkene somehow? Absolutely. Using exactly the same kind of bulky, hindered base that we saw just a few moments ago. Only one type of elimination is possible because there's only one neighbor to the functional group. And so this series of reactions would be exactly the right answer. First, do an elimination to make the alkene, and then react the alkene to make an alkyl halide. Now this quarter, you're not going to have many problems like this, because the rest of this quarter was going to be spent just finishing learning the reactions. Next quarter then, from the start of the quarter, we're going to start practice in these multi-step reactions, because the eventual type of problem that you're going to have is you'll be given some form of substrate, you'll be given the product, but you won't be told how many steps go in between. Because that's exactly what happens in true life organic synthesis. You have a target you want to make, you've got a selection of starting materials you can buy, and you yourself have to figure out the best way to get between the two. That's the goal of organic chemistry. That's what we are working towards. Yes? Sometimes the isopropoxy ion, where you leave one of the methyl groups out, sometimes that's used, but that's an inexpensive enough compound, and it is more bulky, that is generally the one that's used. Questions? All right. I just very briefly want to give you two more examples. I am watching the time, but I'm just concerned that you have one less lecture day. I mean, you already have two less lab days than the other section, but you also have one less lecture day. So I want to show you just a couple of quickie examples, and then we'll move into lab. First of these involves a problem that someone brought to office hours. I think this is a problem from the book that they were asking a question about, where you had, let's see what it was. Ah, yes. A leaving group that was trans to a methyl group. And you're given, yet again, that same bulky, strong base. What will be the product of this reaction? Take 20, 30 seconds and come up with the answer. Now, by the way, those fill-in-the-blank problems that we did earlier, the eventual expected time to solving each problem is about 1 minute. That's again why you need these flashcards, so that as you're reviewing, you can see a reaction, and especially if you're given the set of reagents, you should just instantly say, oh, Br2, bromination. Alcohol and acid catalyst, electrophilic addition. So I'm just putting it out there that eventually that's our goal, to see one of these problems and within about a minute solve it. While you're doing that, I'm going to check on something. Now, this is going to be an E2 reaction. Hopefully you recognize that, because it's a secondary substrate and it is a strong hindered base. If you're remembering some of the examples we've done in the past, you might think, ooh, he's probably trying to catch us on that syn-periplanar, anti-periplanar geometric consideration. So, what's the only product going to be in this reaction? This. And not just because it's the thermodynamically less favored product, which is what you should get from this kind of bulky base. It is also because, if we were to draw a chair structure for this, and we look at the position of the chlorine versus the methyl group, the methyl group can become anti-periplanar to that chlorine, but the hydrogen cannot. In this example, we would have a 60-degree dihedral angle between the chlorine and the hydrogen. Even if we did a ring flip, we're still not going to end up with anti-periplanar geometry. So elimination cannot happen from that position where the methyl group is, even ignoring this idea of kinetic versus thermodynamic control. So that's one of the two examples I want to give. The other one's the following. So predict the possible products of this reaction. And actually, for this one, don't even worry about syn-periplanar or anti-periplanar. Oh, I guess I should throw one more hydrogen in here. Well, if we were ignoring configuration, it looks like there would be two products we would be able to form. But one of them is a physically impossible molecule. This is our first example of a bicyclic compound. And in polycyclic compounds like this, there are what are known as bridgehead positions. So if you imagine that little peak that I've got in the molecule as being metaphorically a type of bridge, the bridge head is the entry onto the bridge. So that bridge head position on rings of that are small in size, which at the moment, let's not get worried about exactly what size does either ring need to be. But I'll just tell you, it needs to be substantially larger than what we've got here. These bridge head carbons cannot become planar because you would force such angle strain on everything attached to them, it just simply would never get there. It has to become planar if it's going to become an alkene. And so it just won't happen. This is a phenomenon known as Brett's rule. So first, a bridgehead carbon is a carbon at the junction of two what are called fused rings. It's not just one ring that happens to have just one contact point with another. These are rings that are effectively squished together. Brett's rule says, that elimination is not possible to a bridgehead position. Unless the rings are involved. Are large. And again, don't at the moment worry about the exact cutoff. So questions about either of these two small examples that we just did? All right, then as far as what we need to accomplish today, let me go back to what I was saying about the starting material for this lab. So we have run out of the bottle of the still beam dye bromide, and so we do need to use your own reagents for this procedure. Again, the procedure does call for 800 milligrams of the starting material. If you have more than that, only use 800. Well, actually, I'd take that back. Save a tiny bit so that if we still manage to squeak some time in to analyze your compounds by NMR, we could. But otherwise, use only 800 milligrams of your product so that if someone else doesn't have any, that you would be able to share. If you yourself don't have 800 milligrams, then again, just adjust the proportions of all the other reagents in that experiment appropriately. So for example, if you had 400 milligrams of your material available, instead of 800, you'd cut all the other quantities in half. If you have to reduce your quantities, the only difficulty that you may have is seeing these two layers that are supposed to form as you heat the mixture up. So, in that case, if you're having difficulty seeing the two layers, as long as you're ensuring that you're heating vigorously, I would say you need no more than about a half hour of heating time based on what the other two sections were able to accomplish. It looked like the reactions did work in all except one or two cases, and I'm still not quite sure why those two cases went awry. But the only difficulty you might have is seeing the formation of the two layers. From what I can tell, there is actually no harm in overheating. I'm presuming the only reason it says to heat 5 minutes beyond the formation of those two layers is that additional heating just wouldn't be necessary. So if you can't see the two layers, that's why I'm just presuming the way that, about the timing that people did get that layer split. For many people, it happened within 5-10 minutes. So half an hour should be plenty of time for heating. Now, the one problem that we have, which is a great annoyance to all of us instructors at the moment, is that the vacuum system has again failed. And you do need to do a Hirsch filtration. Now, we have all loudly complained about the fact that the vacuum system is down, but just because we're upset with it doesn't mean it magically is going to fix itself. So we're just having to kind of muddle along at the moment, which means instead of doing that Hirsch filtration, you'll have to do a gravity filtration, which is where you use a standard glass funnel. You'll get a piece of filter paper folded up into quarters like I showed you way back earlier in the quarter. That's going to be the one timing problem today, where even once you do your reaction, once you're trying to filter it, that filter can go very slowly. There is one way, one trick that I know that sometimes works to speed that up, but I would suggest that you do it with a gloved hand. Whereas if you put your hand and cover the entire top of that funnel and press on it, you're literally forcing the solvent through the filter. And if you keep doing it a little bit of a time, you might speed up the rate at which that solvent passes through the filter. You have to be careful doing that because each time you press, when you lift up again, if you lift up too rapidly, you're going to cause suction, which is going to cause the top level of that liquid to pop out at you. But it's one way you might be able to speed up the process. You can stop this reaction at any point. You can stop the handling of this reaction at any point. So hopefully, you'll do the reaction, get through the filtering in time to save the solid and dispose of the liquid. You are saving the solid, not the liquid. You are filtering out the product. Solids may be stored without being contained. You do need to label them still, but you don't have to have it in a sealed container. Liquids need to be sealed. So if you don't make it through your filtration, then the part that won't come through the filter, that you do have to put in its own container, store it. The part that came through, you can just dispose of. But just make sure that you're watching your timing. We've got 1 hour and 5 minutes left. Please make sure that you have cleaned up whatever stage you've gotten to by that time, because I do need to be somewhere else at 2:30 today. Questions? Yes? Actually, that's one problem. We are also out of the xylenes. I'm presuming because we didn't expect to have this third section and we just didn't have enough chemicals on hand. Now, based on the IRs of what I've seen so far, people that have showed me, it looks like every person had a beautifully successful reaction with that still being. Bromination is just a very reliable reaction in this case. So even if you don't recrystallize, my guess is that you're going to have no more than a percent's worth of any kind of impurity. And so it's not going to interfere with you being able to do the next step of the reaction. Yes?
But this one is said to get the melting point, the weight, percent yield, do a Bayer's test, and this is what I said in the lab.
The melting point we're going to skip because we've already done it once, and we're not going to learn anything useful from it, really, that IR wouldn't tell us. The Bayer test is a test for unsaturation, which I guess I'll go over that briefly on Tuesday. That I'll say is optional, but it's so quick that I don't see why you wouldn't do it. It probably says in the text to do NMR, but there's obviously not enough time for us to do NMR on every experiment, so we're going to skip it for this. So the only characterization you have to do is IR. Questions? Let's go ahead and get to work then.